I could do a better Pauly Shore. Fucking Cassidy, you have me recording this shit late at night when I am like, I'm not on my impression game. And this shit goes out in the world. The leaning t- nope. Fuck it.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again, co-host Keith Foster, San Diego, California.
That's right, Jabberjaws and Drone Strikes. I'm back. And we have another guest for Guest Timber.
Guest Timber. Last guest of Guest Timber is with us again, friend of the show, Ashley Hitchcock from Las Vegas, Nevada. Say hello.
Hey, everyone. Hello. Hey.
She's so polite.
You're far too polite for podcasting. This is, we want your gut reactions. We want your real talk.
You'll get it later.
We want you to be like, yeah, the director's a fucking dick. Or that bitch is a bitch. Or that asshole's a cock.
I do love how much you swear on the podcast. I think it's increased my enjoyment of it since Richard left. Sorry, Richard.
Do I swear more than Richard?
Oh, hell yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, fuck.
You make us earn our explicit rating on iTunes.
Yeah, fuck it.
Yeah, so you're literally doing this in between. Like, you're on a break from work right now.
Yes.
And I think we might have talked about this the last time you were on the show. We talked about Star Wars Rogue One, but, like, you teach Chinese children how to speak English.
Yes, I teach English as a second language online, and it's basically a Skype classroom where I upload a PowerPoint and I can see the studio, or I can see the student, they can see me, and yes, I teach them English.
See, now when you first explained this to me the last time we talked to each other, I thought it was much more, I don't know what I thought. I guess I thought it was a lot like doing this podcast, but then when I went to your house a little while later and I saw you have, you kind of have like a low key studio set up. Like you have like lights.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You have like it's a, legit.
You know, a little sign behind you. You have props.
Yeah. Yeah. You need some props and some puppets just to kind of get the young kids involved. Maybe they're a little scared or nervous because they've never had this kind of experience.
In all fairness, I have all that stuff for the podcast, but it's a podcast. So our listeners never get to see it.
Yeah, Keith is constantly using puppets and props when he's doing his reviews.
But I invested a lot of money, unfortunately.
He did not exactly know what we were doing when I asked him to do this.
No way, really?
No.
No, that's all a lie.
Good.
Today we're going to be talking about Mother. So. We're going to review Kingsman, The Golden Circle. That one we all saw. And then at the very end, we're going to review Spike Lee's She's Gotta Have It from Netflix. Before we get into it, I wanted to play a game. We don't really have much in the way of movie news, but I thought of a game that I thought was kind of fun that I like to call...
Don't call it a comeback!
Ooh, all right.
I have three actors who we haven't seen in a little while, who were at one time kind of big, within our lifetimes, kind of big, but have kind of been lying dormant in obscurity. And I kind of thought of, like, what would be the exact role they need to have in order to have a comeback? Like a Tarantinian comeback where you walk out of the theater and go, you know what? So-and-so is actually surprisingly good.
And by Tarantinian comeback, you're referring to John Travolta's second coming after Pulp Fiction, right?
Sure, or Pam Grier and Jackie Brown or David Carradine in Kill Bill. He'd like to do that a lot.
Yeah, yeah. I think John Travolta is like the perfect example because he legitimately went on to have a very successful career outside of Tarantino after that.
Right, exactly.
He flushed it all away on Scientology.
Yeah.
I hate finding out who are Scientologists. It kind of just ruins my day.
And it's always a big surprise. Did you not know
he was?
No. Oh, I can never watch Grease again.
Oh, he's one of
them. Oh, man. He's like... Yeah, he's up there.
Like up there with Tom Cruise, like one of the more famous ones. Yeah, for sure.
Battlefield Earth, all about Scientology, basically.
Mm-hmm.
We should watch that sometime. Is that on Netflix?
Is it? We definitely should. I saw 25% of that movie before the reel burned when I went to the movie and tried to watch it.
Oh, please tell me a projectionist was just like, nope, not having it.
Maybe. I don't know the full story.
We'll have to save that one. Remind me later.
For sure. Anyway, so going into this, it doesn't necessarily have to be a Tarantino-style film or a Tarantino-style role, but what is the exact kind of role that they need to do that would actually legitimately bring them back? It's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be whatever. So, first on the docket, Matthew Fox.
Okay. Okay, that's Jack from Lost, right?
Jack from Lost. Geez. Matthew Fox. What is it? What's the type of role he should do?
What was the last thing I saw him in? What was the last thing he did? Was it Speed Racer?
No. He did that Alex Cross movie where he tried to break from his type to play like a serial killer, and it really did not play out for him. But he was also directed by a hack, so that also wasn't helping him. And playing opposite Tyler Perry.
Yeah. So I think he's got kind of a boring, serious white guy problem. So I think it's hard for him to get cast and stuff because there's a lot of boring, serious white guy roles.
Mm-hmm.
But there's people that are younger and more boring and more serious and more white than him. So it's like it's challenging. Right.
Right. He doesn't exactly have a hook as an actor. Like he can totally do the thing you want him to do if you just want him to be, you know, sincere and pretty enough for the camera.
Yeah. So I'm thinking he's got to do something. He's got to do something bold to stand out. Like he needs like an awesome cameo in a slapstick comedy. A la Tom Cruise in Tropic Thunder.
Mm.
That's what he needs, is something just like really goofball.
That
you're like, was that Matthew Fox? Holy hell, I didn't know he could do that weird, you know, paraplegic that farts diarrhea. Like, he needs something like that. Just totally, just prove that he's not a boring stick in the mud.
Right. To show that he has some sort of range outside of what we've seen in Lost.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's my call. What's your take, Ashley?
You know, I think he just needs to embrace his boring white man problem and just star in a really just totally campy rom-com, like 27 Dresses or Maid of Honor or something like that, and just go with it. Just be seen as charming and then kind of be someone that the ladies fawn over for a couple of rom-coms. Like Gerard Butler even did that for a little while.
Yeah, well, but Gerard Butler, look where it ended up. Gerard Butler.
Gerard Butler regularly does that. I think that's something he actually could do or probably has been approached to do and maybe for whatever reason decided not to. But that's not going to bring him back. That's just going to keep him working.
Well, there's a difference between working first.
Yeah, but what's going to be the thing that like pulls him like up to the point where he's getting those like second or third parts in like the big David O. Russell movie of the year or whatever it is?
He is going to play a sassy gay robot in a sci-fi comedy.
Yeah, that's a variation on the theme you brought up earlier.
I'm telling you, that's what it's gotta be. He's gotta sign on for for like a Marvel movie. Like, I don't think he could go full superhero, but he could definitely be like a supporting villain or something, like Crossbones type. Not Crossbones, because that character already exists, but someone like that.
Yeah, I think I thought about Marvel too, because he has the build, and I think, like, you know, it doesn't take a ton to be serviceable in those movies, because they're so regimented in effects and spectacle. So I think he could definitely do that. I could see him being like a decent, like, third tier hero who, like, kind of comes in and has like a fun one or two scenes.
See, I see
maybe
him
steals
more as,
those scenes.
I see him more as a third tier villain.
But the third tier villain, I don't think, is going to bring you anything. Like, the first tier villains barely exist in those movies.
I'm thinking more like Netflix universe, even. You know, if, because he never made it as a movie star, really.
No.
So go back to your TV roots. If he got like a meaty enough role as like maybe kind of a heavy or like a faux heavy, like, you know, halfway through the season he gets killed off or whatever, but you're like, oh man, I'm kind of bummed out because Matthew Fox's Electro was like, it was like cool.
Yeah.
Or Matthew Fox's The Night Stalker. That was, that was brilliant. Something like that would be cool.
Yeah, I actually, that's a good one. I was thinking sort of along the lines of like, it's sort of a variation on your theme of like a Coen Brothers movie where he plays like an outrageous Southern detective or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where with like a bad comb over and like an old jacket with like the patches on the elbows. And he's like, you know, gets to deliver like good dialogue.
Oh, yeah, the bodies. Oh, no, there ain't no bodies left. Yeah, yeah. Turns out there was some kind of cannibals or something. They was just eating all those bodies up.
Oscar-winning dialogue from Keith Foster.
You want some stew? I got some stew for you. It ain't made out of people. I know I probably shouldn't have mentioned it right after the cannibalism, but, you know, gotta eat.
Right. So Keith's never seen a Coen Brothers film. He's doing an impression,
you know,
as if he has.
Improvising Coen Brothers is harder than it sounds.
I think that's, yes, it is. Okay, so that I would think that's a good take on Matthew Fox. Second on the list, Alicia Silverstone.
Okay.
Oh gosh, I love her.
But we all love her in one movie.
I know.
Yeah. She needs...
We didn't love her in Batman, you guys?
I thought that's what we were talking about.
Oh.
No, I was talking about excess baggage with Benicio del Toro.
This whole podcast could just be us shitting on Alicia Silverstone's career.
What about The Crush with Cary Elwes?
I loved her with Blast from the Past. That was such a great movie.
That was good, yeah. But that was also like... That and I think
it wasn't great because of her.
No, like anybody could have kind of done that, but she was good at doing it.
So I have mine. If anybody else wants to,
I have no idea. You go first.
Yeah, for sure.
I think she needs. Again, it's got to be something surprising and something like, whoa, where the fuck did she come from? So I'm thinking like, this is my pitch to Hollywood. If you're listening, David Hollywood, is like a desperate Housewives of Orange County kind of thing, but she's also a serial killer.
Okay, I like it.
So kind of campy, kind of maybe like sort of like a John Watersy type of thing.
Yeah, yeah, kind of like what that TV show The Santa Clarita Diet with Drew Barrymore, where she's like a zombie, like that but less fucking stupid.
Yeah, I was just gonna ask, did you like that, because I couldn't watch it.
No, it looked really bad, so I didn't bother. But something like a dark comedy cheesy, vampy thing. Yeah, like John Waters meets Beetlejuice, kind of.
Right, right. Where she really kind of gets to play into her cougarness.
Yeah, yeah, and play into that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually so good. Now I don't know if I have one.
I have another one
for her. Call. Okay.
Like a Britney Spears biopic that only focuses on her mental breakdown years.
What?
Yeah, that's number two.
That is like it. I mean, okay.
That's depressing. No.
That would be fun to watch if it was really bad and on Lifetime.
No.
Are you kidding me?
But not, it's not bringing her back.
I think it might, because it if it's like,
she's already too age inappropriate to play it.
No, she's not. She's like the same age as Britney Spears, isn't she?
She was born in 76. When was Britney born?
I guess Britney's
80 probably or so, 81 or two.
She was born. It doesn't say on IMDb.
Oh.
That information's in a vault somewhere.
Wait, 1981.
We're gonna get to the bottom of this.
1981.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So she is a little older. A little older. Like but 5 years. Still.
I would have said yes. Going comedy and going light, or going, you know, dark comedy or something like that would work. I think it would be a good turn for her. But I think also like, being in like something like a Up in the Air style or some like,
what's her name,
Vera Farmiga.
Yeah, if she did like that kind of turn.
Sure, like playing opposite somebody with a lot of like a Brad Pitt or a George Clooney or something like that. Somebody with a lot of Hollywood gravitas. And they really got to play off of each other, and she got to play her age and be like classy and again given good dialogue.
Mm-hmm. You know what? She actually,
well, she's kind of crazy. Like, first of all, like in IRL in real life, she's one of those like anti-vaxxers and like constantly talks about like her health food diets. She's sort of
she's an anti-vaxxer.
Yeah.
Oh, I hate celebrities.
You know what? She doesn't need a career. Let's not give her a platform to come back. I withdraw my awesome idea, David Hollywood.
I would write that for her.
Do you have one, Ashley?
Oh, I agree with you. I think Up in the Air would be a really fun idea. I would totally watch that.
Something in that vein, sort of like a Jason Reitman or an Alexander Payne kind of style, like dramedy about people in their midlife crisis, existential, whatever.
Because she is older and she needs to. Yeah, she needs to play her age and yes, have good dialogue, like you said, because there's not enough of that currently.
So are you telling me that Diary of a Wimpy Kid isn't going to be her big comeback?
Again,
with
she's
goofy glasses in it.
She's working. Just, yeah, so, you know, good for her as far as that goes. And she's in the sphere, either if it's for her, you know, horrible views on everything, or for being in those kinds of movies, she's in the bubble enough that, you know, she could get a script.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, last one.
Okay.
And this is the toughie. And I don't mean this as a joke. I mean, legitimately, you would walk out being like, you know who was surprisingly good? Pauly Shore.
Okay. I've never seen any of his movies, so I can't even tell you.
I mean, you've seen a Goofy movie, right?
That does not count.
It kind of does.
Oh,
like he's playing an animated version of himself. Of
the character he was in all of those movies.
Yeah. The Leaning Tower of Giza. I could do a better Pauly Shore. Fucking Cassidy, you have me recording this shit late at night when I am like, I'm not on my impression game. And this shit goes out in the world. the Leaning nope. Fuck it. I'll work on that one. I'll workshop it. Anyway. So I mean he needs some kind of he's kind of playing himself, but like a fictionalized version of himself that's like kind of a sad sack.
Yeah, like an underdog. Like you want to, the movie would have to make you root for him somehow.
Yeah, like it should be about a comedian who, you know, who was almost like a BoJack Horseman, but in real life, not animated, if that makes sense. And as a movie.
So you would place him as the star.
Yeah.
Like
a Funny People kind of thing, but but a different take on it. Like one that's specific to Pauly Shore, like play to all his strengths. But I would say make him less of an asshole and make him more just kind of pathetic, like a sad sack.
Well, I'm on your wavelength there as far as a character archetype. But I have him more as a secondary, tertiary character who has, like, again, sort of like the Matthew Fox thing, has, like, one or two really great scenes in an otherwise great movie.
I think Pauly Shore is the level of obscurity to, at that point, he would just sort of become a character actor.
Right.
It's got to be a star vehicle that's like, holy shit, where did that come from? That's the harshing on the Wheeze guy from the '90s.
I think you would need a little bit of a lead up to that, though. I don't think he could. I think if you just released a movie right now, said blah blah blah, starring Pauly Shore, great reviews, you know, Sundance raves.
I still think it would fly. Pauly Shore. I mean, you would sell it on some indie director winning at Sundance.
Right, right, right. The movie I see in my head is kind of like a remember that movie? It kind of came and went, so like this, but better. Remember that movie, Killing Them Softly?
Yeah.
With Brad Pitt, the crime movie. Mm-hmm. Remember,
That's funny you bring that up.
Why?
Because you guys are reviewing Mother, and I think Killing Them Softly was the last movie to get an F cinema score.
Oh, yeah. Maybe that's in my mind because I read something about that.
Yeah, so it's just kind of ironic. But anyway. Yeah.
And kind of underrated, actually. But remember that little part that Scoot McNairy played in that, where he had, like, this really intense... he always... Like, basically, the Scoot McNairy role in a movie, where... it's either Killing Him Softly or in Gone Girl, where he has, like, one really crazy interrogation or interview scene where he's just, like, letting it all out, and it's... super afraid of what's going to happen. And then I think you follow the character a little bit, and you're sort of rooting for him and you think he might make it or something, but then he totally gets ganked by the bad guy and is either the inciting incident or the incident in the middle of the movie to let you know shit's just got real.
Okay, so if like a substantial supporting part.
Yes. But a character part.
Yeah, that could do it. Sort of like I was gonna say like a Casey Affleck in The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, but he was sort of the lead in that.
Yeah, I'd say that's definitely much more crucial to that movie.
Whatever it is, it's got to be some kind of tragicomic thing.
Yeah, where he's funny, but he's also like definitely kind of pathetic, but also like. Sympathetic as well.
A different kind of funny than we're used to from Pauly Shore.
Because I was watching this interview with him where I forget with who it was with, but he was just like he was just like talking about when he was the biggest thing in the world and he was on MTV all the time and he's like, I missed that. And it was just like genuinely sad.
Yeah. That's why I think like a comedian story who fell from grace.
I could see him being in a Judd Apatow movie. That wouldn't surprise me at all. It's like random-ass people Apatow, he brings in.
If you're listening...
make it happen.
Make it happen, but don't, because it's our idea.
All right.
I'm actually sort of bummed out now that all of these projects aren't real.
I know. I don't like playing this game.
I don't like it because it's like, A... we're better at this than fuck you, Hollywood. And B, fuck you, Hollywood.
Hey, it's a dog-eat-dog world out here. Chews you up and spits you out.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's... Don't call it a comeback!
That was good. That was good. We still haven't played my game that I brought up to you.
We will. We will eventually, I'm sure. Okay, Ashley, let's get into it. We're going to start with the reviews now. And let's talk about Darren Aronofsky's Mother.
Why don't you summarize the movie?
Okay. I'll try and give the cleanest synopsis you can of this movie. So, Jennifer Lawrence and Javier Bardem play a newlywed couple who have moved out into the middle of nowhere in this old house that's been recently devastated by a fire, and they're trying to rebuild. Javier Bardem is a poet who has writer's block, and he's trying to work on his magnum opus and, you know, get away from everybody and everything to be able to do that. Jennifer Lawrence is sort of a doting wife who has some sort of existential angst about whether or not she wants to be a mother, whether or not her life is headed in the right direction. We kind of get some of these ideas through dialogue as the movie goes. Ed Harris shows up out of nowhere. He's a fan of Javier Bardem, and he's dying. This is, I guess it's kind of sort of a reveal, but there's no way else to really explain the plot otherwise.
And who cares? Like, nothing comes of that.
So Ed Harris comes in. Michelle Pfeiffer plays his oversharing, overbearing wife. And they're kind of wrecking the place and sort of making it their own. Jennifer Lawrence is having a nervous breakdown, both literally and figuratively. And then all of a sudden, more guests arrive and more guests arrive who are related to them. And things kind of, you know, shit hits the fan. And it becomes increasingly more clear as the movie goes that even though we're seeing everything from Jennifer Lawrence's perspective, it's very, 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 very much from her subjective experience. The camera's almost on her close-up for the entire time. And it's all in one location in this house. She seems to have no control over anything that's going on. It has its very, if I'm allowed to use a hoity-toity, critic-y word, it's very Kafka-esque in the way that she's sort of just this thing living in a world that she can't control, but seems to be solipsistically torturing her for some reason. Yeah, this is a Darren Aronofsky film, I think, through and through. If there's some of the stuff we saw, especially the subjective camera work and the existential sort of thriller-ish stuff we've seen bits of in stuff like Black Swan. It has that kind of ratcheting tension that both Black Swan and Requiem for a Dream and Pi had. And in a way, it sort of marries all of those genres and concerns in this, I don't know, a passion project, I guess you want to call it. Ashley, what did you think of Mother?
Well, I first want to point out that because it's told from one person's point of view and there's no real argument or contradictions from that because we are pretty much just seeing it from her point of view. And as she gets more and more frustrated with the more and more guests come into her house and start fucking it up. Mm-hmm. And we just know only her experience and what she feels, which is frustration and like horror and anger at everything in her life falling apart. And so I think that it's an allegory or a parable itself because anyone can perceive this movie any way they want to, and no one is wrong.
Almost, yeah.
I mean, yeah. So going into it, I knew that it was basically based on the Bible, and Adam and Eve are the guests that come, Ed Harris and Michelle Pfeiffer. And so they're Adam and Eve, and then their sons come, Cain and Abel, and they, you know, that happens. And then obviously her husband is God and she is Mother Earth. And so going into the film, I knew that was what was going to be the plot line, basically. So I think I was obviously way more prepared than a lot of other people who, like we've said, have gone into it thinking that it was a horror movie, and it's just not. It's so not that. And I think obviously they marketed that wrong, and I think they just did it to themselves with everyone being so upset and giving it an F score. It wouldn't have necessarily gotten that score, I think, had he just been up front and said, this is an art movie. Get ready.
I think that's kind of probably what happened to Killing Them Softly, too, is,
right.
is I think it was sort of marketed as this like action-y gangster film. And it's not really. I mean, there's gangsters in it, but you know what I mean. It's not like
right. Yes, I agree. This is in the case of the news surrounding it, because everyone's kind of treating this already. Even though generally critically, it's somewhere in the middle. I think it's like a 60%. It's just right above Rotten. You know, it is a very divisive movie, but I think that it was definitely a problem with marketing first, most and foremost. Because if you've seen Black Swan. And you've seen Requiem for a Dream, and you've seen his past work,
mm-hmm.
You might think it's that type of thing, where it's just sort of a genre exercise, like Black Swan, which is, again, I think I said somewhere on on Facebook or something like that, that somebody talked about this being an art house film. I said, but marketed like a horror film, and Black Swan, ironically, was a horror film that was marketed as an art house film.
Yeah,
but
I have a question, and this might get a little bit away from the review because again I didn't see it, but is Jennifer Lawrence like one flop away from not being America's sweetheart anymore?
Oh, what? She's on thin ice. Yeah,
no, for sure. Disagree. No,
yeah. So this tanked and is very divisive for audiences. Sure. Passengers mm-hmm. tanked.
She was totally surprised by that.
Yeah, I mean, it was should have been a slam dunk.
She thought it was great.
You got Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence. Like, that should have been enough. You know, 10 years ago, that would have been. But
hey, it was enough for people like my sister who just love rom-coms. So I think it's enough for a lot of people.
Still didn't do well, and critically was pretty bad. X-Men Apocalypse was not rated well. Joy was not the hit
that
I love
David O. Russell and her wanted it to be. Like, I think she's got a kind of...
She's definitely on thin ice. I agree, Keith. Yeah, there's sort of... She got overexposed there around, like, 2009 to 2015.
Yeah, like which is unfortunate. It makes it hard
for... Yeah, nothing to do with her.
No, it's... But unfortunately, she's in the position of superstardom, which makes risky choices hard.
Yeah, she can't turn down the X-Men movies or whatever, even though I think the last one was her last one.
No,
another one's coming out.
For Phoenix, which I think is going to be worse for her.
Uh-huh. Yeah, at this point, anything that's even remotely bad for her career is going to hit doubly hard.
Yeah.
Because people are kind of sick of her, and I think that she just isn't getting great parts anymore. And it's not her fault. I mean, working with Darren Aronofsky, even though I thought his Noah movie was pretty bad, at this point should seem like the smart thing to do, especially when you're the star and you are the movie, you know, literally hangs on her performance, which I'll say, even though I'm not crazy about the movie as a whole, I think she's really good in it and she has a ton she has to do.
Right.
But, the problem with the movie, I think, ultimately, is there's kind of a tension that exists between the ambition of the storytelling and of the symbolism, because the entire thing is sort of symbolism, and you spelled it out pretty well as far as I think you know what Aronofsky meant by the movie. But you know, I was also seeing like feminist allegories about domesticity. I was also seeing allegories about what it's like to be a celebrity in the eye of the media, and all of these things kind of trickle in there, but none of it actually, it kind of just goes from one allegory to another without actually having much connective tissue or any kind of way to marry any of it. And I think that the ambition of that really grinds pretty hard against the fact that it's like all this Steadicam stuff that is like shoved up Jennifer Lawrence's nose the whole time. And
I got really tired of seeing all of the shots
of her
behind her head.
Behind her head and her face. Which I think that subjective camera stuff is like in The Wrestler, an Aronofsky film. I think that was really, really useful and helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But here, it not so much. It's because it's a chamber piece. It's all in one house. You could almost do this as a play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I think it'd probably work better as a play.
Yeah, that might actually be more entertaining.
Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't be able to have as many effects. Now, there is some bloodletting. There's some horror movie imagery. I mean, there's a scene where she goes into the basement and they literally take a shot straight out of Evil Dead where the light bulb fills with blood and then pops. And then there's there's some shocking kind of stuff in here, but there's usually some, you know, I think, Requiem for a Dream is a horror film, even though it's like a don't do drugs, drama about heroin. I think it's shot like a horror film. And I think that's the stuff that Aronofsky's good at, is visceral cinema. He's not so good at the big picture stuff. He's not so good at telling symbolism. That's why I think movies like The Fountain and movies like this just kind of leave people scratching their heads going, I guess, when they walk out of the theater, because he has all these ideas, and even Noah had this problem too. He has all these ideas that he's trying to be profound, and it never works with the type of cinema he's interested in.
Hmm.
I don't know. Would you agree with that?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know him. I'm not the person that you are, where you know every director and every movie they've ever done. I only know my opinion of this movie.
Right, but based upon what you've seen here in Mother, would you say that there is some a weird tension that exists between all the big picture stuff of the allegories and whatever and the symbolism, and then the fact that it's like this tiny contained movie that feels claustrophobic?
I think that it's not exactly a good movie. Like you said, there's a lot of symbolism that doesn't really pull together, and you, but that's the point. I think that's the point. He wants you to take whatever you need to take away from it, which for some people, it might be environmentalism, like that we worship a made-up man in the sky and we have no fucks about the planet we live on. Like, that's completely stupid. Mm-hmm. I think that, to me, it points out how stupid that is. And then it's, I personally found the film to be like pro-atheist, pro-environmentalism. And that's what I took away from it. But someone else could take away something positive about the God figure in it, because at the end of the day, after all the trauma that she's been through, he's like, we still need to find a way to forgive them. And she's like, the fuck? So I think that you can take it any way you want it. And that's the way I took it. And I just am at peace with that. I'm not looking for some kind of bigger, like, is the symbolism correct? Is the setting correct? Is it claustrophobic?
Nah, okay, yeah. Okay. So the movie worked for you then, or more so than it did for me?
Well, no. What does it mean, worked? Like, that's so...
In the sense that, like, you felt that the movie accomplished what it set out to do.
I don't know what the movie sets out to accomplish, because like I said, I think you can take it any way you want to. So if people want to find meaning in it, or they just want to hate it because they're like, I didn't get it. Well, I guess you could go either way.
Okay.
You know what? I'm glad you actually brought up those other Darren Aronofsky films, because I forgot that Hugh Jackman survived The Fountain and Emma Watson survived Noah. So maybe there is hope for Jennifer Lawrence's career.
All I'm saying is, if the people who saw The Fountain, if you just remember Hugh Jackman in a bubble, there's a lot of Hugh Jackman in a bubble in Mother. Like, there's a lot of that kind of.
Okay,
what's going on here?
Hate The Fountain. I don't know. I want to see this movie still, just because of all the controversy.
Sure.
But I'm not in any hurry.
Yeah, I mean, it's not. It's the thing is, there's no way it can live up to the publicity at this point, because it's not. It's not going to be as bad as the people who hate it says it is, and it's not going to be. It's not going to be like as good as the movie wants you to think it is either, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, there are people who probably this is firing on all cylinders, and this is the movie that Aronofsky always wanted to make. In some regards, it is that. There are some things that I do like about it. I think that, like I said, the visceral cinema stuff, like, you know, when it does kind of go into horror movie mode, or when it does kind of go into thriller, like, there's some shocks in here. Like, Chris and Wig has a moment where I'm like, Jesus, right? Jesus fucking Christ. And, you know, there, and, like, the stuff I mentioned with, like, the sort of Shining-esque Evil Dead stuff in the movie sort of works on a visceral level. And, I, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer kind of killing it in this movie. She's vamping it up and having a whole lot of fun, and seems like the only one in the movie kind of who's kind of rolling their eyes at all of this.
I think she's entering a cool, like, third act of her career.
Totally. And I'm all for that. So I think there's stuff to like here. I just, it's
all right. It's time. Letter score.
I gave it a C minus.
I think there, of course, like you said, I think there's things to like about it, but I never want to watch that again. So I would probably give it, C minus as well.
All right. Okay. Interesting. I will say,
just because I can take away something from it and appreciate what it's trying to do doesn't mean it should be viewed by everyone. Like, that's sure a lot of people don't like it and wouldn't enjoy viewing it. And that's okay.
Yeah. I think as a play, this movie would work, or this story would work, because it wouldn't feel as claustrophobic. I feel like Lars von Trier could have done this movie, and I know that he's a controversial figure, and a lot of people don't like his stuff. But in a way, this material fits what he does, I think, better than Aronofsky. Okay, so let's get into the review of the week, I suppose, which is Kingsman: The Golden Circle. And Keith, I'll have you describe that one.
All right. Yeah. So this is a sequel to the 2014 movie Kingsman: The Secret Service. Eggsy is back on another mission to save the world. I think it takes place pretty soon after the ending of the first movie. Like almost directly after, I think.
Maybe like 3 to 6 months or something.
Yeah, not long. So he gets attacked by a guy that I totally forgot about from the first movie, which turns out is working for this secret spy lady. She's not a spy. She's a drug dealer. And she's slowly poisoning her drugs to try and blackmail the American government into legalizing drugs. And so Eggsy has to go on an adventure to save everybody, to save the world. In the typical take on spy movie,
James Bondian adventures, globetrotting.
It's like more shiny than that too. It's super stylized.
Yeah, just like the first one. It's like pulp cotton candy version.
Yeah,
it's like if James Bond is an orange. This is artificial orange flavor.
This is the what's a sunny delight of James Bond?
Yeah, this is those chocolate oranges that you crack open. That, you know, they look like an orange. They kind of smell like an orange, but they're candy. It's candy. Yeah,
totally. Yeah. It's directed by Matthew Vaughn, who also did the first one, who also did Kick-Ass, and which is. Both Kick-Ass and the Kingsman movies are based on material from the comic writer Mark Millar.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, these are Mark Millar 100%, and I think they're Matthew Vaughn 100%. The two have very similar sensibilities. I'm not surprised that he's done more than one adaptation.
I'm just going to say this about Mark Millar real quick. Before we get onto this movie, I have sort of a love-hate relationship with Mark Millar.
I think most people do, yeah.
Yeah, I think he's got some great stories in him, obviously. I mean, Netflix just bought the Mark Millar-iverse, which we'll see how that works out, because, I mean, most of it has already been adapted into movies, I feel like. I don't know that I want to see a lot of the Mark Millar-verse on screen. I think Matthew Vaughn does a good job of, like, showing some of the more extreme stuff, but also in a way that's not going to make you just feel super icky.
He makes it a little bit more populist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like there's still that kind of cynical, satirical edge that Millar brings to his stuff. Like,
yeah, but
Millar, it doesn't, it never goes, well, I
think I said this when we talked about Logan, is I just think Millar needs a good editor. Because there's sometimes, like, I get what he's all about, and there's sometimes when it works, but there's sometimes when he gets so in his way with shock value that it's like, you lost that other cool moment. But that's not these movies. These movies, especially this one, actually, I think this one is even more palatable than the first one as far as shocking content goes. There wasn't anything that made me go, well, okay, there was one scene that I was like, oh, okay, that's a bit excessive.
This one, I think, leans into the comedy a little bit more than they both are funny enough. It's been a while since I've seen the first one, but I feel like this one has more like gags in it, like more specific like comedic setups.
Well, this one is more of a straight-up spy movie and less of a postmodern take on a spy movie, if that makes sense. Like, I feel like the first one was playing with a lot of those conventions, and this one was playing into those conventions.
A little bit, yeah. Especially, like, there's a scene at the end that takes place on a snowy mountain, which immediately makes you think of Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Or even Spectre.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Which was riffing on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Yes, yeah.
There's more globetrotting in this one. There's more gadgets in this one. It is, I think it's definitely a sequel in that it's just everything but a little bit more. Everything's kind of cranked up to 11 from the last movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes that's an issue, Ashley?
Yeah, I would agree. What are your takes on this, Ashley?
Well, I'm going to probably give less of a like a true movie critic opinion, which is just that I had so much fun watching it and I really liked it and I kind of want to watch it again immediately.
Oh, wow. Okay. So very positively.
Yeah. I think that just accept it for what it is and enjoy it. And then I think it's a little too much to be 2.5 hours long. Two hours and 21 minutes is a bit much, but what it does do, it just understands that if you want the fun campy, then it's going to give you it. And I feel like it's action packed the whole way through, like within 30 seconds of the movie beginning, there's action happening. And, I
would agree with you in that, audiences should just accept it for what it is. I think once you start poking holes, you start to notice the holes. But if you just kind of enjoy the ride, it's pretty fun, was my take on it.
Well, you specifically, Ashley, you just watched the first one and the second one almost back to back.
Yeah.
So did you feel like the transition between the two was pretty seamless?
The second one does seem like different to me. The first one, of course, is an origin story. We have seen origin stories a million times, thanks to Marvel, which I love Marvel, don't get me wrong. But I kind of liked the second one more because it wasn't about, like, you've got to find your true self, find your inner strength, you know?
Yeah, you get to see spies doing spy like? Shit.
Yeah, exactly. Like, immediately, you get to see all that cool stuff that you actually want to spend the whole movie watching. So I liked the second one, but maybe a little better than the first.
I'm going to play a little bit of a devil's advocate there on you. You do get to see spies doing spy shit. I mean, one of the things, I think one of the charm about the first one is how British it is. It's like they make a big point out of that aspect of James Bond where he's got to be charming and polite and all of this stuff. I think at this point in the review, I don't know what's a spoiler in this movie because a lot of it is given away in the trailers.
If it's trailer, it's up for game.
If you're listening to this podcast, you know that you should have seen the movie by now.
Within the first 5 minutes, they blow up the world that
that was so
carefully established.
Right.
So that's a little frustrating. Is yeah. like,
but that's also a little bit of a like a spy movie trope. I feel like both James Bond and the Mission Impossible movies have played that game where they're like, oh, there's an insider in, and now this person's out, and this person's out. There's only three of us left. We got to figure out what's going on.
Yeah,
like that's happened a lot. I think the last Fast and Furious did something to that effect.
Sure. I'll get into my issue. I guess I'll just get into it now.
Sure.
Again, just going into this movie as pure popcorn fluff, it's great. There's great action sequences. I do think it's funnier than the first one. I don't know. It's pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the sexual politics at play in this movie kind of bugged me.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's also a trope of spy movies, but it sort of just irked me. The first one at least had a cool female character who was competent. She got sidelined for most of the movie, but she was there, you know. And in this one, she's literally blown up within the first few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then all we're left with is Halle Berry. Gross.
Actually, I think she's kind of good in this. She doesn't have a ton to do. But I sort of liked her, and I liked her relationship with Mark Strong. I thought that was a fun little pairing.
Yeah, okay, I'll give you that. I just don't like her. But you're right. she was palatable in this, and her character was fine. And I think that's what bothered me, is they kind of try to address these sexual politics with her character, but it's very half-assed. And
well, there's so the last movie, and then I don't know how much of this is in the original comic or whatever, or what's been adapted, what hasn't.
I think this movie is pretty much its own thing.
Right. So in the last movie, there was this little gag at the end. It was just sort of a throwaway line of dialogue where Taron Egerton, the main character, walks past the princess he just saved and says something to the effect of, like, I'm going to fuck you in the ass later. And that was
it's like, if you save the world, you can do anal.
Right, right. It was some joke, anal sex joke. So that, like, blew up the internet. Like, as silly and throwaway as that line was, that, like, blew up the internet. And that was one of the many things a lot of people had a problem with.
Mm-hmm.
And the violence and all the rest of it, but specifically that. So in this movie, from scene one, Taron Egerton is with said princess. They are a committed couple, and they make almost painstaking attempts to show you that all the way through. She is his inspiration throughout mm-hmm. the whole movie. And almost I feel like it's an over-apology. It sort of over-corrects.
Exactly. And
weirdly brings and more attention to it.
That's what rubbed me the wrong way about it, was it was like, yeah, we hear you. We're trying to be aware of this, but then it just sort of makes all the same mistakes, like the excessive fingering scene, which has some shady undertones. I mean, obviously, there's the surface level where it's just the plot, and he's a spy trying to seduce her, but it's like.
Mm-hmm.
It does become this problematic issue of consent, and that scene kind of made me feel.
No, I feel you, yeah.
It's the movie's unawareness of those issues, and the fact that he is in a committed relationship with the princess sort of proves that it's like, oh, we didn't really get it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the fact that they, like, again, even in that scene, had to address it in some way to be like, no, we get what you're trying to say. We're trying to be on your side. It's like, it's a little too self-aware of it wanting to be the bad boy.
Yes.
And also at the same time trying to be culturally appropriate. It's like, you kind of have to choose one or the other on this.
Yeah. And I think that's what kind of held me back a little bit from this movie was that it did try to toe the line, whereas the first movie didn't.
No, really. And that was one of the things I liked about it, was it was like, you know, they didn't sell it on that, because I don't know how you sell the first movie, but
no,
they
it's insane that a sequel even got made
for sure.
It was a hit. Like,
Agreed. Yeah, I mean, the first one, one of the things I liked about it was totally non-PC, and it was just doing what it wanted to do. You know, everyone be damned. And I didn't. That doesn't mean I loved every single decision it made, but I was like, you were the movie you wanted to be, and very few people get to make that movie.
I loved the boldness of the first movie.
Sort of the punk rock energy of the first movie.
And the sequel, this one, Golden Circle, feels like it was maybe trying a little too hard.
Yeah, here's my issue with the movie. I mean, you know, all the things that you mentioned were there. Those aren't things that I necessarily would ding against the movie too much, but they were certainly noticeable.
That was just sort of an example.
No, yeah. My issue, I think, kind of comes more to what Ashley was saying, is like, this is 2 hours and 21 minutes long, and it really feels like 2 hours and 21 minutes. Like, yes, it's action-packed, there's a lot of set pieces, but there's, every time something isn't happening, it really feels like nothing's happening. And there's lulls in this movie where the movie is almost dead in its tracks, and I'm just like, all right, guys, get on with it already, get on with it. And then something fun will happen, or something really funny will happen. There's all this stuff with Elton John that's hilarious, and then I'm like, I'm with it again. I'm like, okay, yeah, the movie finally is catching traction. And then after scenes like that, it would go right back into another lull, and I'll be like, oh, Jesus Christ. Like, this movie is paced kind of bad, and I think at least 20 minutes could fall out of it easily.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So this question is for both of you guys. Uh-huh. Did Elton John wear out his welcome?
No, I thought that joke was funny throughout.
I think that I just thought there was going to be like a 5 second cameo, and the fact that he kept coming up through the movie and kind of had this supporting role, I was like, yes, like I'm here for this. Yeah,
I was into it. It's a little Austin Power-ish. Like, it's kind of not this movie, but I still kind of went with it. I thought it was funny, and you know, like, again, sort of like Mother, but in a completely different way. There's individual parts and aspects of it that I liked a lot. I liked Julianne Moore essentially reprising Tilda Swinton's role from Oakjaw. Like, I thought she was entertaining as this like campy weird lady in the middle of the woods.
Acting was really good. Even Taron Egerton, and maybe it's just because
I think he's better in this. Yeah,
yeah. Maybe it's just because I'm more familiar with him. Mm-hmm. I dig him. I want to see him do more stuff now.
Mark Strong, I think, is really good in this.
Mark Strong. Channing Tatum has a deceptively small role, but it's fun.
Yeah, I was sad about that.
Pedro Pascal is great. I thought all of the actors were totally on board for their silliness. Like I said, even Halle Berry, I normally hate, and I didn't hate her. Which is the biggest compliment I can give her. Yeah, I agree. Also, kind of a weird side note. This is the second movie we've seen in, like, within 2 months with Channing Tatum that heavily features the song Country Road.
Right?
Oh, that is weird.
I was driving home and thinking that.
I just now put that together, yeah.
It weirded. Out.
That was weird.
Where it's not only just like a song in the background, but it has like a story purpose.
Like, it's the one character's favorite song, and in Logan Lucky, it's his favorite song. It was really weird.
Yeah.
So that's a little sidebar. I was ranting about something. I don't.
I was just talking about how there's individual things about the movie I like, but I think the movie suffers as a whole. It reminded me, in a weird way, it reminded me a little bit of Kick-Ass 2, where it's like, all the stuff I liked about the first one just didn't quite have the same charm the second time around for me.
Oh, yeah, Elton John. He was dangerously close to wearing out his welcome for me.
But did he, officially?
No, he didn't. But it was like down to the wire. He was like one scene away from me going, okay, enough. I did sort of want it to be, like, secretly revealed that he used to be a Kingsman or something, though.
Yeah, that would have been fun.
Especially after he was, like, doing these crazy kung fu moves. That was the part where I was like, okay, this is cutting it close. But, I liked this more than Kick-Ass 2. Like, I think this
Yeah, is... I would agree with that. I think it's a more, it's a sturdier movie than Kick-Ass 2. Plus, Kick-Ass 2 was picked up by a different director, so it kind of lost a little bit in the translation.
Yeah, whereas I do think this is a good sequel to... To me, this is Wayne's World 2 to Wayne's World.
Yeah, totally. That's a great comparison.
Like, there's all the fun of the first one. It's just not quite as good.
And it's just a little bit more is more. Like, I felt like even the action stuff of that, like, pushing, pulling camera sort of Guy Ritchie stuff that
Vaughn likes to do. Yeah, it made it feel a little sanitized.
It's a little fakey in this movie.
Yeah, in the first one, though, it felt like... edgy and visceral, and maybe that's because of the scene with
Colin Firth
which I was glad to see him back, but that did kind of lower the stakes a lot for me.
Yeah, that was a little Men in Black 2-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like I was
but,
like,
but at the same time I was like, I was so happy to see him back that I kind of didn't care. But then, you know, other characters are getting shot in the head and it really doesn't matter anymore. And it's like, okay. Yeah.
The way I would describe this movie is like, if you end up catching this on cable and you're like, oh, I didn't see this one, I kind of like the first one, you'll probably like it. Like it's consistent enough. I would say
even if you saw the first one in theaters and liked it, I think this is worth going to see. It's just... you know, have the expectations of a sequel. Don't expect it to be a Spider-Man 2 and be better than the first one. Just expect it to be like fun, like a fun time at the movies. Don't poke holes, because then all you'll see is the holes.
Yeah. I think that the whole drug premise was really fun, and I kind of enjoyed seeing how that was going to play out. And I mean, of course, you know that they're going to, like, save the world, but it was really fun, the tension that they kind of built up over that issue. And it is an interesting end the war on drugs. Like, I think that's kind of a fun premise to talk about. Yeah. Nowadays.
Well, that's the kind of, like, sharp satire that, like, both Matthew Vaughn at his best and both Mark Millar at his best can kind of approach from a genre angle. And I thought that stuff was really interesting. I wish that had played a little bit more throughout. I feel like that issue sort of gets wedged in there sort of at the zero hour.
I think there's a few thematic themes trying to work their way out too, that there is so much going on in this movie, and it is so long that most of the sort of bigger themes get lost, like the war on drugs, like the sexual politics, the deal with his relationship. And you know, I felt like there could have been maybe more of a metaphor there. Like at the end when, spoilers, when he marries the princess and you see the two rings and it's like, it focuses on them being golden circles. I was like, were they trying to play this relationship metaphor? Like, because I did not pick it up till just now. And you know what I mean?
Right.
And I felt like there was a lot of that. Like, was there supposed to be a metaphor there? And that, you know, just kind of got lost along the way with the fluff and the laser whips and the robot dogs, which I liked all that.
Right, right. I think we got down to it. I mean, do you want to put a letter grade on it? For me, it's kind of a B minus.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Wow.
I would say about the same, but in a good way.
Yeah.
In like a B movie kind of way.
A satisfying Saturday rental.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd watch it again.
Yeah, Kate hasn't seen it, my boyfriend, so I'm happy to watch it with him again.
Okay. Yeah. All right, then that's that. Let's go ahead and get into the Netflix homework. She's Gotta Have It.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to describe this one? We've each done one.
Well, okay. I get nervous. Okay, so this is a movie by Spike Lee. He directed it, and it takes place in 1986, I believe. And it's just about this woman, this African-American woman, and she's living in Brooklyn. And she kind of has these three men that she's sleeping with simultaneously, and it's kind of booty calls. She'll call them up and they'll meet her, or they want to meet her and she meets them, etc. So she's very open about her sexuality and is not afraid to kind of embrace who she is naturally. And basically the story is all of these men getting jealous and kind of wanting to control her and own her, essentially. And one man in particular gets really attached and wants to, yeah, essentially just be like, commit to me, only sleep with me, tell people that you're with me.
This is Spike Lee's first film. He did this right out of film school in 1986. He plays one of the key roles here, one of her suitors.
Mars.
Yeah. And kind of, I mean, steals the show. And in a movie full of, I would say, like, sort of community theater style acting. Mm-hmm. And I mean that in the most positive way possible.
Yeah, in an endearing way.
Like, yeah, it's... in an endearing sort of amateurish sort of way. I think that he actually, like, from the get-go, you're like, oh, I can see, like, why this guy became a cult of personality, besides the fact that he was a successful independent filmmaker.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I read your little your tweet storm, Keith.
Yeah.
While I was at work, in the bathroom, I read your live tweeting of watching this, and you made some interesting points, specifically about, like, why does how is it that everyone talks so much about Clerks and nobody really talks about this movie as much? I mean, obviously, people in sort of, like, film world do talk about this movie quite a bit. But
sure.
Outside, but it doesn't have the same kind of cult appeal that, like, Clerks does.
And I think there's a couple reasons for that. One is Clerks is white. I mean, I think that mm-hmm. makes a big difference.
Wasn't it in the 90s, it was, like, a Living Single, I think. And then it's, like, Friends was white, and Friends is way more popular now.
Yeah. So I think that plays an aspect in it. I also think that there is the whole nerd culture that was able to develop a cult audience, whereas this is aspiring to be kind of more. Whereas it, like, I feel like Kevin Smith saw She's Gotta Have It and was like, oh, I could do that. And he made it about his life, you know, which is fine. But along the way, I think this movie kind of maybe got forgotten about, which happens in cinema. Like, it does.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, but, you know, Spike Lee, I think, eclipsed this movie. It's good. It's, you know, decent as I think this movie is. I think, you know, but if you make Do the Right Thing, mm-hmm. anything before Do the Right Thing is just not going to really be worth talking about all that much anymore.
That's true. That does, I think, probably play a huge part in it.
Yeah, he developed a lot, I would say, a lot more than Kevin Smith as a director, even though, you know, he's had his ups and downs. You know, Spike Lee's sort of a controversial figure out there, and sometimes I think that's fair, and sometimes I think that's really, really unfair.
I mean, this came out in 1986, and I think it kind of set a lot of standards for what independent film would become. Like, I was kind of blown away by it. Honestly, I was like, oh, holy shit, I have seen this move ripped off by other movies.
Sure, definitely. So both Spike Lee and Jim Jarmusch, She's Gotta Have It and Jim Jarmusch's Strangers in Paradise or Then Paradise. I forget which one's which. One's a comic, one's a movie. But Jim Jarmusch, they came around, I think, within a year of each other. They were both black and white, 16mm New York directors. And that was sort of what started the, you know, the first wave, I guess, of, like, the independent boom, which really happened after Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape in 1989. And then the 90s happened, and Miramax happened, and all of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, this movie felt like a Miramax movie.
It would have been had they existed as a company yet.
Well, I think you could make the argument that Miramax might not have existed had this movie not existed.
Right. It's just sort of a chicken egg thing, yeah, for sure. And of course, you know, I think Spike Lee, his direction style, he had all of the things he's known for doing, the confessionals, the direct to camera stuff, the quick cuts, his type of dialogue, the type of characters he likes to write, where they're characters, but they also are sort of standing in for a societal archetype. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's also worth noting. I mean, this movie, in some ways, it's kind of dated. But in some ways, it's like still really contemporary and ahead of
its
time.
Oh yeah, I think I think it completely holds up.
Yeah, like I mean, when I say dated, I mean like some of the ways. Obviously, the camera's kind of grainy.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I think
it's low budget. Like it's.
Yeah, yeah. I think acting nowadays, you're able to. Because things are all digital, you know, you can keep doing take after take after take until you get it just right. Whereas this is, you know, some of the acting's a little wooden. Mm-hmm. Greer Childs in particular. Oh, he was cracking me up. but the content is mm-hmm. there. Like,
yeah,
it's sort of insane to me how, you know, this is a movie that portrays a black woman who is sexually liberated and does not condemn her.
Yeah.
This was in 1986, and it's fucking 2017, and we still can't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's sleeping with three guys openly. Huh. They're all aware of the situation. They don't necessarily like it because, you know, and there's a lot he's saying about masculinity there. Uh-huh. And possessiveness. But, like, you don't see black people in movies portrayed like this.
Outside of Spike Lee movies, for sure.
Yeah, and it's sort of insane to me. You know, like, they're characters. They're, you know, they're not gangbangers and pimps. And it's, you know, they're just people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of bonkers to me, like, watching this movie. I was like, holy fuck. It just sort of made me realize how far back Hollywood still is.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Ashley?
Oh, I was going to say, race aside, I was just watching it and going, holy shit, this is the pilot of Sex and the City, the pilot episode from 1998. And this was filmed in 1986. This came out so much longer ago than mm-hmm. The Sex and the City pilot. And I said, oh my gosh, Sex and the City stole all of their ideas for the pilot from this movie. Because there's like that kind of confessional, like straight at the camera, you know, mm-hmm. all women want to, you know, do this, blah, blah, blah. And just like these statements that these douchey guys made. And it's exactly Sex and the City. And I just thought that was... It's so genius that it mm-hmm. just tackles these straight on way before HBO was talking about it. And also, one of the reasons why I think the movie has held up so well is because this is in the middle of the complete AIDS epidemic in America, mm-hmm. and yet it's not spoken about, and that's not the focus, because what it's about is a woman's sexuality. It's not about sex and STDs. It's not about any of that. And so I respect that they put that aside, and that's why this movie is still relevant. I feel like super relevant today.
Yeah, and the movie doesn't shame her for being sexual. It embraces it. Like, that's her story, you know? Exactly. That is who she is, and why should she be any different? Mm-hmm. And I was a little afraid at the ending. I was like, no, don't, you know? I mm-hmm. thought it was going to have a more...
conventional ending?
Yeah, and it didn't. I was like, yeah, and that's where it really got me, was mm-hmm. the ending stuck to its guns and was like, no, this character is who she is, and this, the movie wasn't about her having to change. It was about these three guys having to deal with the fact that she wouldn't change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that scene, and kind of exemplifies everything, that scene where they have Thanksgiving together, mm-hmm. which is both a great like comedic set piece. It's just a really funny scene, and mm-hmm. and you know, the way all of their because I think up to that point we don't really see them together all that much, and
I think that was the first time
first time they all meet. Yeah. And she thought that would somehow be a great idea.
Well, and that was actually, around the time when I stopped tweeting, because I was like...
Holy shit, yeah.
Yeah, I was just really into it.
Rubber hits a road. And that's a type of scene that in like a movie that would come out today, like if it was a Katherine Heigl vehicle, that would be a very kind of sitcom-y, kind of ridiculous mm-hmm. scene. But here it actually kind of works, and it's funny. And again, because the characters aren't are also societal archetypes, you're seeing bigger stuff at play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think this is great. I think it's, you know, I talk about independent film when that word used to mean something. I think mm-hmm. nowadays you rent an indie film, I'm using air quotes, and it looks like something that could be on TV, or it looks like something that could come direct to Netflix, and it just feels like, I hate the fact that indie became a genre.
Yeah.
And I think that the experimentalism of independent film has kind of been lost in the last few decades. Mm-hmm. Like the focus features era on, I think independent film doesn't really mean anything. You know, they're just a different type of star vehicle now. But I think if you go back this far, specifically to like, you know, the early Spike Lee films, the early Jim Jarmusch films, the early Gus Van Sant films, even up through, you know, to the mid-90s or so, it was a much more radical, alive cinema that felt like sort of America's version of, like, the French New Wave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's actually what this felt like a lot to me, was from the opening yeah. credits, when it's all black and white, and there's just sort of the slow jazz music, I'm like, oh, God, here we go. And I was, like, sort of mad at you in that moment, because I didn't know the context of this when I watched it. But then, as I was, like, figuring out what this movie was about, I was like, oh, no, holy shit, like, this is actually really cool.
Yeah. The last, like, independent film that I felt, like, had this kind of energy, and I was like, yes, fucking yes, was Tangerine, the yeah. movie that came out a couple years ago that was made on an iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
I know of it, but yeah. Had you seen this before you assigned it to me?
No, I'd seen a handful of Spike Lee movies. I'd seen Do the Right Thing. I'd seen 25th Hour and a few other things. But I saw that it was on there. And I was like, holy shit, I've always wanted to see this. So it was just a good opportunity to do so.
Gotcha. Okay. I just wasn't sure if you had like had any informed decisions about it or anything.
No,
like that.
I mean, I knew of it. I knew that it was a thing. I'd meant to see it.
Yeah, no, I was surprised at how relevant and funny and contemporary it felt. Like I said, it's sort of insane to me that I haven't heard about it, and you know, I think it is just the circles I run in. Mm-hmm. You know, Clerks was just speaking more to the demographics I fall into, but I think if you are a fan of Clerks from a filmmaking perspective, you should definitely see this, because I think it does everything Clerks does, A, first, and B, I think a little bit better. I think there's just kind of more going on here.
Yeah,
this has more to say.
I mean, stylistically, the two movies are very similar, but I think, you know, Clerks is a lot more dedicated to being a straight comedy, whereas this is a little bit, it's funny, but it's also a little bit more nuanced. It's doing a little bit more.
It's not, I wouldn't describe this movie as hilarious either. Like, even saying it's a comedy it's funny, but it's a little, it's very subtle in its humor.
I mean, yeah, there's a rape scene in here. Like, it's not exactly a comedy to me. I was really worried about her at first.
Mm-hmm. That scene's really intense and kind of hard to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not entirely, like, it's a scene that I think might divide people. I'm not even 100% on it myself. I'm like, would that have made my final edit? I don't know. But, But it's there, and they, you know, it's one of those, it's like these type of movies, it didn't have that kind of Hollywood system sort of telling it couldn't be there.
Well, what if, I mean, if that scene hadn't been in there, what would have really pushed her over the edge and thinking, oh, well, gosh, I guess I need to just choose one person and settle down. I think that was the catalyst for that decision, mm-hmm. for her to try it for a while. I think
also the way she kind of deals with it, like this movie, that scene is tricky because she doesn't get victimized out of it, which I like.
Right.
But yeah, that's this movie was saying a lot about toxic masculinity, about embracing feminine sexuality. Like I almost want to watch it again just because I think there's a lot of layers there. As far as sort of the exact opposite of Kingsman, Golden Circle, as far as sexual politics.
Well, the more you look at it, the less it holds together. This one is the opposite.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things. I think was my big takeaway. It was just really bold to have a female protagonist.
I think I liked the depth of her character, that you see these men just be so dumb, and kind of like the one guy, the athletic guy, is just straight up like, if you weren't good looking, I wouldn't even bother with you. The second you get fat, I'm leaving you. All of these like behaviors that they have, and she still puts up with them. And so I think for me, I enjoyed watching her. She's not a perfect character, and I get that, because she's not this totally like person that embraces her sexuality and doesn't put up with bullshit from men. She kind of puts up with lots of bullshit from men and embraces her sexuality. And so I think that, yes, this is the journey she has to go on to realize she's not going to put up with men's bullshit. And that's the conclusion she has to come to. But she has to go through dating shitty men first. And so it's frustrating, because you're like, what the fuck are you doing with him? Even if it's just to sleep around, get away. But she has to do that first in order to grow.
The scene where Greer Childs is like undressing and she's waiting to have sex. That was like so funny. The funniest.
And he's like carefully folding his tie and everything. Yeah.
And his boxers.
That was good.
And I knew that was like a rated R film.
The one thing I'll say that I think dates this movie the most is that the apartment she lives in, you would have to be a literal millionaire
Live
in now. A literal millionaire.
And she's so young that I was like,
she's just like this cool bohemian artist or whatever. It's like, no, you would be, nowadays you'd be living in someone's closet for like $500 a month.
Mm-hmm. No, it would be way more. My friend Jake literally lives in a closet for $900 a month.
Oh, Jesus.
In a Harry Potter room,
Technically, he lives like in Manhattan in the East Village, and she lives in Brooklyn, which is a little cheaper, but still. The fact that she has that whole loft and she's like, oh, it's really cheap. I was just like,
with 12-foot ceilings. And I'm happy and surprised that the movie went over as well as it did with you guys, because I kind of thought you guys both going to be mad at me about it. But
Why?
I don't know, because it's an old, grainy thing, and, you know, whatever. But I'm glad that it
dude? I took a film, like a film appreciation class.
I know, but, you know.
Old, boring movies.
I know, but some people have a hard time kind of, like, getting over the time and place a movie's made to be able to appreciate it on its own merits. But I'm glad that you did.
I definitely have to be in a mindset, and I think that's why I put it off for so long.
Mm-hmm.
Once the movie was going, I was like, oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, Keith, what are you assigning me for the first review we're going to do in October?
Okay, so I do want to give a shout-out to Patrick. He recommended we watch Icarus. Mm-hmm. I want to save that, because you told me that for October we do horror and horror adjacent movies.
For the Netflix homework, yes.
Yeah, for the Netflix homework. So we will get to Icarus. It will just probably have to wait till November. And then, because I'm not a huge horror hound usually.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been kind of going back and forth on what I was going to give you. I'm like, do I want to ease into it? And I'm deciding no. This is going to be Shocktober. Okay. I'm assigning you it's a Turkish horror film called Baskin.
Oh, yeah. That was on Richard's Top 10 last year.
Oh, did you watch it?
No, but I wanted to. So
we can do that. Yeah, we're doing it. Baskin.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. You've heard of it.
Yeah, we'll get into it. I'm kind of excited to watch that with you. All right. Ashley, thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
And thank you for being a good sport with all the, you had to do, you had to watch a lot of movies. You've watched more than, anybody this week. Yeah. Counting watching the first Kingsman to watch the second one and watching Mother, and you did the whole thing.
Yeah. So it's fun.
And is there anything that you want people to follow you on? Do you have an Instagram? Do you have a Twitter? Do you have any socials?
You can follow me on Instagram. It's Ashley Hitchcock. It's A-S-H-L-E-E, not E-Y. And it's Hitchcock like Alfred Hitchcock.
And how about, are you on Twitter? Do you care about that?
I don't do Twitter.
Okay. All right.
I have a Twitter of the same name, but I don't do Twitter.
All right.
You're not missing much.
It's just not my platform. Yeah. I like Instagram.
It's there. All right, Keith, what about you?
Follow me at Keith Foster Kid on Twitter and Instagram. I'm on Twitter, even though I hate it. I think I'm on Facebook at Keith Foster Kid too. I think you can find me there. Go to www.keithfosterkid.com for updates about shows and stuff. Right now I'm pretty much just balls deep in Tonight in San Diego. Also check that out. It's been a really good chunk of episodes so far. The last week we had a guest host who was really fun. The week before that we had another guest host who was really cool. Jesse came back this week. We had MasterChef season 8 winner Dino on the show last night. He was a lot of fun. That should be coming out this week. And attendance has been great. So if you're interested, get some tickets and come, because we almost sold out yesterday. So
wow.
Are you going to have a show over Thanksgiving?
Our last show is November 20th. So whatever that means.
That's the week before Thanksgiving.
Okay, yeah. And we're done for the year after that. But yeah, come check it out. Still lots of shows to come to. Tonightinsandiego.com, and you can follow the show on Tonight in San Diego on all the social media.
Cool. You can find me individually on Twitter at VC Cassidy, V as in Victor, CCASSIDY. You can find the podcast Twitter at Jabber Podcast. You can find the podcast's Facebook page at facebook.com/JabberPodcast. You can email us with any questions or comments you have about anything we talked about today at jabberandthedrone@gmail.com. You can find the show's archives and our RSS feed at jabberandthedrone.podbean.com. And you can also stream and listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Google Play, Pocket Cast. That might be it. For a little while, we were doing the Windows Podcast Network. That's it. Did that one specifically for Keith when he had a Windows phone.
Which I no longer have.
Yeah.
Yay.
So now literally nobody needs to know that. I do movie reviews weekly for the Idaho State Journal. I just uploaded a couple last night, trying to get all my backlogged reviews up there again. And you can find that at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. And that's it. We have friends who do podcasts. You should be listening to them as well. Rod and Denise at The Listening Party, Denise at Mascot Diaries, and Patrick and his father at Make Dad Read Comics.
Oh yeah. I'm going to, we've set a date. I'm officially actually gonna guest on Make Dad Read Comics, in October. So
fun. Cool.
Keep your eyes out for that. That should be fun.
Yeah, and we'll post that on our socials as well.
We're going to read. I'm making Dad read Hellboy, so that should be exciting.
Yeah, and Halloween appropriate.
Yeah.
Patrick has another podcast. He talks about history and politics and other stuff with his friend Dennis at Almost Educational. And that's it.
Give it to Gosling.
What?
Bye.